carryover from yesterday on Senate Bill 5528. This is subcommittee of the Subcommittee on General Government, Ways and Means. This continues on with the 5528, which deals with the legislative branch agencies, and we carried over Indian Commission on Indian Services. Karen Quigley was here. So, Karen, could please come forward. We apologize for having you come 2 days, but appreciate your flexibility.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Quigley, and it is my honor to serve as the Executive Officer of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. I'm here today to respectfully request your continued support for the commission, and I appreciate the opportunity to just take a little bit of your time to explain what it is the commission does and how we're doing. Your Legislative Commission has a vital function in state-tribal relations. All 40 states with federally recognized tribes have a state-supported Indian Council, Office of Indian Affairs, or Indian Commission. The reason for this is because of the legal status of tribes, sovereigns within state borders. State governments understand the need for a vehicle to keep open a channel of productive communication and a way to sustain a working relationship with these special governments. You should be proud of Oregon and Oregon's Legislative Commission on Indian Services. It is known nationwide as having perhaps the most effective commission. The commission is noted nationally for promoting positive state-tribal relations and avoiding costly litigation by encouraging methods in which state agencies and tribes can discuss matters on a regular basis rather than only during a crisis situation. Several states, including Alaska, Wisconsin, and Nevada, have invited me to come talk to them, legislators and tribal representatives, and they have ended up copying critical components of the Oregon model. I'd like to point out that the commission and its office is well respected by both the state and the tribes. It is seen as a resource for both the state and the tribes, and it is seen as a way to conduct a lot of the diplomatic behind-the-scenes work that results in better outcomes in terms of not missing opportunities to partner, leverage each other's limited funds, co-manage shared resources, and make decisions about which government, state or tribal, would be the most effective and efficient provider of services in a particular area. For the past 27 years, since the initial efforts of then-legislator Vicatia, the commission has had direct representation of leadership from Oregon tribes and Oregon Indian communities.
Karen, question, were we one of the first states?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes. This is unique to have all nine tribes represented on a commission. A lot of other commissions just have state officials without the representation from tribal leadership. The commission consists of 13 members, the tribal chair, vice chair, or tribal council member from each of the nine federally recognized tribes, two Indians representing Oregon's large non-reservation population, and two legislators, Senator Kate Brown and Representative Greg Smith. The commission conducts formal business at its quarterly commission meetings. Most are held at the state capitol, but usually once a year we go to one of the tribal reservations. In response to its statutory responsibilities, the commissioners use their meetings to compile information, to assess state programs and policies, and make recommendations for improvements, and to encourage public and private agencies to expand and improve their services to Oregon's Indian population. Because 10 governments are represented on the commission, the state of Oregon and 9 Indian governments, the commission is obviously an advisory commission, not an advocacy commission.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. Ms. Quigley, I know that you've held your position for some time and that you've seen legislators come and go as they have been appointed to the commission. Without going into specifics, but just as a as an overall, have the legislators that have been appointed been engaged and an active part of your work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, Senator Kate Brown has been a very, very active participant. The House member at this point has been much less so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Commission meetings have included discussions with governors, legislative leaders, the attorneys general, secretaries of state, the treasurer, state agency directors, and deputy directors. These discussions have focused on both immediate issues and long-term solutions. It was out of the commission meetings that the idea developed for Executive Order 9630, one on state-tribal government-to-government relations, which was among one of the first in the nation, and the codification, and this is the first one and only in the nation, the state statute, which was requested by the Commission on Indian Services and was Senate Bill 770 in the 2001 session. And it requires state agencies to take tribal interests into account when their programs or policies affect tribal interests, and obviously you have to have communication with tribes to know when that occurs, to work on a government-to-government basis with tribes, to provide annual training to state managers who deal with tribes, to hold an annual summit with tribal leaders and the governor and state representatives, and we have been honored to have a legislative panel for the last two annual summits, and I'm hopeful that some of you might be willing to participate in the upcoming summit. And
it's in May, is it not, Karen?
Mr. Chair, I believe with the governor, I've just had very initial discussions. We'll probably have it in the fall.
Oh, okay.
Tribal Information Day at the state capitol
is
May
22nd. May
22nd? Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And to have state agencies provide the commission with an annual report on their individual agencies' work with tribes. And I have delivered this to some leadership offices. We're making limited copies of everything. But I think this is a particularly useful document. There's a table of contents with the 26 state agencies that deal the most with tribes. You can find your favorite agency and look at their two-page memo about what it is they've done with individual tribes for the past year. And I think it might surprise you how much interaction there is between the various state agencies and Oregon tribes. The commission office located in room 167 here at the state capitol is busy year-round. It is the point of contact for the state on Indian issues. When a legislator, a state agency, a member of the public, a federal agency, or someone from out of state calls with a question about Indians and tribes in Oregon, this is where they call. Or if they call somewhere else, this is where their call eventually gets directed. I was telling Larry earlier that this morning already the Department of Forestry has contacted me to find out whether the Forest Practices Act or tribal forestry law applies on a certain piece of land that a tribe may own.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. Ms. Quigley, when you're asked a very complicated legal question like that with perhaps far-reaching ramifications, walk me through the process of consultation that you use.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm an attorney, so that's a helpful start with 8 years' experience in Indian law. I would, this is a basic question and more or less confirming the department's initial feel about how it is. If it's tribal lands, in this case the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, they would have jurisdiction in a regulatory manner like forest practices. They are talking about lands that the Warm Springs have acquired that are currently in private property status. If that's the case, state law would have jurisdiction. If those private lands are put into trust by the federal government, they essentially assume the status of tribal lands, tribal jurisdiction. So that's just... that particular question was not so complex.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, please, Representative Johnson.
Well, maybe in trying to probe a little deeper in this regard, how fortunate Oregon is to have an attorney with expertise in Indian law. At some point, you are not going to be there anymore, and what I'm trying to get some reassurance about are that there are procedures and practices in place in the office that if there was someone less skillful than you there, how would these kinds of complex legal questions be resolved in a way that protects all of the parties involved from having an opinion circulated from one of our commissions that maybe hasn't been vetted with the AG or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I am in close contact with the Department of Justice. Sat a meeting with the Attorney General and Stephanie Striffler, who is his special attorney dealing with Indian issues. I was on the phone with her yesterday about a matter of contracts and the waiver of sovereign immunity, so close conversation. I talk with Greg Chamoff. You are correct to assume that there is not a lot of expertise in Indian law. It's a small field, a complex field, and an unusual field of law. But there are enough ways to get some conversation going. There are our tribal attorneys. I'm a member of the Indian law section of the Oregon State Bar.
Sure.
I don't know if that addresses...
At the risk of just beating this to death, let me try to put a slightly finer point on it. Were you to decide to retire tomorrow, are there elements of the job description that call for the level of expertise that you have? I know that Indian law is a very narrow field. I'm delighted that one of our law schools here in Oregon has a special emphasis in that area. But to try to make sure that one of the reasons the commission has worked so well is the level of expertise that you bring to your job, and I'm looking for some reassurance that should you elect to no longer pursue this career path, that the state of Oregon would have built in to the job description the kind of protections that would bring another applicant of your qualifications to this important job.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, being an attorney is not a specific requirement of the job as far as I know. I believe previous director had been an attorney with the exception of possibly one. I would also suggest that in addition to someone who's a good attorney that you might want to complement that with someone who was a good diplomat, because an awful lot of what's involved is encouraging people to talk together, even if it were to mean arranging discussions between tribal attorneys and the Department of Justice over some matter. But if your suggestion is that be made a requirement for the position, I think that is probably a very, very good suggestion in terms of the number of legal issues that do come up.
I'm not sure I'm ready to go quite that far. I'm just simply saying that this is an unusual position where you are dealing with complex matters of law. You're dealing with sovereign nations. The word diplomat that you just used, I think, is a very precise and good word. And my concern is to recognize how fortunate we are to have a person of your qualifications and background to be doing this right now, and to do everything we can to try to promote a successor when at some point you decide that it's time to retire, that we have an opportunity to have someone called out in the job description with the unique blend of skills that you obviously bring to the job. That's my whole point. I'm not ready to say it ought to be an attorney. I'm not ready to say anything. I'm just saying the success of this commission depends mightily on the characteristics of the leadership, and to make sure that we have a job description that's drafted reflecting the sensitivities and the expertise called for by your position. That's all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you. It has been noted at the National Conference that the legislators have done an in-depth study of Oregon and what's going on here, and that was one of the comments that they made, that a lot had to do with me, and I don't know how you get around that, how you ensure that those characteristics.
You just don't retire. That's the only answer.
Do I look that old?
No, just with the air rife with people discussing retirements. No, you're the flower of youth.
I just wanted to give you a couple of other examples. While I was in the budget hearing yesterday, a vice chair from one of the tribes called and just asked for some information about some legislative proposals. Stephanie Strickler from the Department of Justice telephoned to talk about that waiver of sovereign immunity and some contracts to facilitate grant applications, because when you're working with tribes, it's not the same as grants with county governments, for example, or something that's a creature of state government. The Department of Consumer and Business Services called me up to see how they could get in contact with someone from the Klamath tribes to give a presentation on some of their services while they were in the area, and we are fortunate that the tribal chairman of the Klamath tribes is the vice chair of the commission, so that the access that I have at the level of tribal governments is, I think, of great benefit to the state in terms of when they make the call and say, I spoke with Karen Quigley, you know, they'll get a response, and I think that, again, is to the state's benefit. Someone from Florida contacted me, had some burial deeds and a note picked up at a yard sale that they were connected to an Oregon tribe and wanted to return them. The Department of Transportation has contacted me to be part of a video this afternoon that they're going to use to train all state agency people. And they wanted me to talk on film about some of the legal principles of sovereignty and the legal background of tribes. But they also wanted to discuss the content of the tape, what they should have on it, and also who the tribal representative should be to kind of catch all the important parts that they need for this training. The governor's legal counsel wanted to talk to me a few days ago about developing relationships with Oregon tribes, as well as to begin discussion of the annual summit called for by statute. This is where I'm in that scary territory of this pig here. The Department of Land Conservation and Development asked me to review some draft county ordinance to see if they conformed with the state's cultural resources law. Water Resources asked for my assistance in a hydroelectric relicensing situation. Fish and Wildlife came by to indicate they would appreciate my ability to suggest someone for them to contact at one of the tribes on a particular issue. I was able to provide some input that hopefully made for more productive government-to-government public safety cluster meeting with the Attorney General, other Department of Justice attorneys, Oregon Youth Authority, Corrections, State Police, and Department of Public Safety and Standards training officials, tribal leaders, and tribal public safety officials. The meeting included discussion of some jurisdictional issues as well as ways for the state and the tribes to cooperate in treatment, post-detention, and training. I've started to plan for the Tribal Information Day at the state capitol, which the chairman mentioned earlier. I have reviewed this week, as I am required by statute under ORS 97, 358, and 290, several archaeological permit applications and designating the appropriate Indian tribe to be consulted on those projects. Other statutory and commission-directed responsibilities require me to review and distribute the state agency's annual government-to-government report, which I showed you earlier, provide consultation on agency training, plan and organize the annual summit, advise and monitor the activities of the six government-to-government issue area cluster groups, which each meet 3 to 4 times a year. And that's where Oregon is distinguishing itself, in the area of natural resources, cultural resources, human services, public safety, education, The tribes and their state agency counterparts meet several times a year just to exchange information.
And Karen, that has something to do with the uniqueness of what you call the Oregon model, with the nine tribes represented, the nine independent sovereign nations inputting information back into the to the Oregon model, back into the agency or the commission. In that process, Karen, are all nine tribes presently represented on the board and active on the board on your commission?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent point that you're raising. They all are, and actually it's the only entity that I know of that all nine tribes agree to sit on and actively participate on.
I think that probably is what distinguishes Oregon because of that active participation. Then,
mm-hmm.
And then you have these other levels of participation with the other processes. Do you actually sit on a rulemaking with agencies that may have issues to bear with the commission then?
Mr. Chair, I am asked to review agency rules, particularly
okay.
rules that affect tribal interests because
okay.
they deal with cultural resource protection or some other issues that affect tribes. So
Karen, in reviewing your budget, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I apologize for interrupting, but we need to kind of push along here. In reviewing your budget, back when you had a vacancy of your assistant, in the office staff, the Ways and Means process and the special sessions went ahead and used that as an efficiency within your office. Are you interviewing presently to replace that staff person?
Mr. Chair, to date we have not replaced that person, although there are many large-scale events, meetings, that having staff support would be very helpful.
Very helpful. I understand you're out of the office working with, and again, because of the As I go through the statutes, you virtually go from one end of the state to the other, from Harney County clear to the coastal tribes in Coquille and clear up to Umatilla to the north. Well, that's up throughout the entire state. So, and I think that's important to continue to have that kind of exposure. I just wanted to make sure that as we get into the budget process, where you were at with regard to any interviewing or searching for a staff person to come and assist you, where you do have these other responsibilities and meet actively with the agencies as well as the nine sovereign nations that are there. I don't know whether I think we've got the budget in front of us. Are there any specific questions that need to be addressed to Karen? I appreciate the same tip, but we are going to need to move along. I think we have the two senators here, and we'll just need to get Representative Patridge before we can start a work session on the next budget. But was there anything else, Karen? I'm sorry to cut you short. But
no problem at all, Mr.
I just wanted to make sure that what it was in the Oregon model that made us unique, and as you travel to other communities, and I notice that you don't have very much travel expense budgeted for here, and very little out of state at this particular point. So as you travel out of state, they must provide that from some other resource then.
Mr. Chair, my visits to other states have been paid for by those states.
Okay, fine. Are there other questions that you may have? Senator Winters, you were involved in some of the early on workup on this, weren't you, of this particular commission?
That's because Governor Attia was the real driver behind the creation of the Indian Commission.
1973 through 75?
And it's kind of interesting because you asked what was unique, and I think there's a lot of unique factors. One, that we were forced to recognize that there needed to be a relationship between the sovereign tribes and the nation and state government. And two, if you look at its composition, it was an attempt to be all-inclusive. And three, in Oregon, if you study some of the tribal histories, you will also see that we, over time, the evolution, you know, you take Warm Springs, you're very much into economic development. They have been, you know, really engaged over a long period of time. So I think that it's just the uniqueness of Oregon and the people that are in Oregon who recognize the value of having not only them involved with us. It's the same thing that I found when I went back to Philadelphia and the issue of minority health. the other states are talking about what we've already done, and I think we tend to be pioneers out here. And hopefully we will continue that spirit and recognize that we do have relationships with others in a very positive way.
Thank you very much, Senator Winters. Thank you, Karen, for being here today and sharing your information about your commission with us, and please continue to do great work. And I think some excellent comments have been made by Representative Johnson as well, relative to the great job you're doing and the uniqueness of having a person with your talents and skills and abilities in that position. And for the other people who provide good help.
Chair, how long has Gladine been with the commission as well?
She was with the commission, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, for 15 years and retired October 31st. Thank you. And
thank you.
Mr. Chair, one last thing. I have a few letters from some tribal chairs.
Great. If you'll give those to Larry, we'll get those in the record.
Thank you very much.
Karen. Appreciate it. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 5528, and we will now open a work session on House Bill 5002, the Department of Administrative Services. For the record, all members are present.
Thank you, sir.
Dallas? Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have a packet in front of you. It's clipped together. The top part of the packet is my memo from you to the committee with a series of recommendations. There's a second sheet that shows savings, estimated savings from reduction, the department's assessments and billings. And we will go through these in more detail briefly, but I just wanted to. The third is one sheet which summarizes the legislative fiscal office recommendation with respect to the overall budget of the agency. And that is a summary of the last packet, which is stapled, which is division by division or unit by unit. It follows the sequence of my memo to you. And this is the detail that agrees and summarizes to this agency overall budget, which is what we use then to amend the bill to provide for limitation and general fund appropriation. If I may, I would like to start with my memo, Mr. Chair.
Please start with your memo.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a kind of a long recommendation. It's four pages of type. And
you'll go through it item by item.
I certainly shall.
Okay.
The first item is to point out that we'll be saving about an estimate of $5 million general fund from making these changes just to the agency budget, from both reductions in general fund appropriation and reductions in expected savings from reductions in limitation and assessments. There are two offices that were presented in the Department of Administrative Services budget. There's a Community Development Office, or Community Solutions. I'm still trying to find a name. And the Arrest and Return Program. Your staff is recommending that both of these functions be taken off of this budget and considered in the Governor's Office budget. The reason for that is we view both of these as gubernatorial responsibilities. The Arrest and Return Program certainly is a gubernatorial responsibility. We have agreement with the Governor's Office that program should be budgeted and for budgetary purposes housed with the Governor's Office. The Governor's Office, and I believe Mr. Weeks here from the Department of Administrative Services, will offer up, they do not agree with my recommendation to house the Community Development Office budgetarily in the Office of the Governor. My reasons for this recommendation is that all testimony indicates that this is a responsibility or a function that really is reporting to the governor and acts on behalf of the governor, and that with respect to budgeting and being tying accountability to budgeting, that when we provide funds through a budget, we should be looking for accountability and responsibility at that office. And for that reason, that is my recommendation that this be taken from the Department of Administrative Services and put with the governor's office.
Okay, discussion regarding that. Representative Patridge?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dallas, I just want to let you know, we're going to be recommending a lower amount for the Attorney General's billing rate than the $99. So there's additional savings there, so just so you know. Senator Devlin, Representative Butler, and I will get to deal with that. It's only a buck lower, but it's still... I've got matters here or there in these budgets.
Mr. Chair, representing Packers members of the committee, I think you'll find later on that a buck will make a lot of difference, particularly in the risk management area.
Yes. But I did want to say, Mr. Chair, I think that that's great, and I agree with LFO's recommendation on the community development offices, and I think you heard some of that when we had them before this committee. I would be wholeheartedly in favor of doing that, and I know that there's a substantive bill that's running around out there that I've seen, that I've amendments on. Yeah, that I've seen amendments on, and I know you have, Mr. Chair, and I imagine they've worked everyone else in this committee, which I still have some trepidation about.
Representative Johnson, did you want to address anything with regard to the Community Development Office of Community Solutions teams? Put it out here.
Well, only just to reiterate the comment that I made during testimony that we have heard about the Community Solutions or Community Development Office. And I have seen them in the field and believe that part of the value that they bring in having parties convene together is the imprimatur of the governor's office. I know that there was quite a bit of debate about institutionalizing their activities in DAS, or in Department of Administrative Services, last session, and that it was really a question, I think, of where they could become institutionalized rather than if they carried the card of one agency versus the governor's office. Personally, I lean in the direction of having them be aligned with the governor's office, be a gubernatorial function, carry that card. I think that's where they bring value. I'm perfectly willing to hear the argument on the other side. I believe it to be only the question of institutionalization. But I have seen the value of them having a card reflective of the governor's office.
I think that in the just immediate prior brief discussion with Director Weeks that this could be in the governor's office. However, that I think the governor would still maintain some degree of oversight coming through Director Weeks, even if it was vested in the governor's budget. So I think we could get it accomplished so that the my concern is to make certain that that the overall community development office answers to someone with sufficient authority to be able to say yes to the decisions that need to be made.
Mr. Chair, I don't know whether or not you want Dallas to finish the description of his memorandum or if it would be appropriate to ask if Mr. Weeks had any comment on this conversation at this juncture.
Well, let's go through the balance of the discussion with regard to the CST and the Community Development Office and the arrest and return. Any discussion with regard to the arrest and return? Recommendations being made here. That certainly appears to be a gubernatorial oversight function. Dallas, did you want to complete that? Is that did you have anything further relative?
I have nothing further to add with respect to the Community Solutions Office and arrest and return.
Then perhaps it would be appropriate to go ahead and have Gary respond, have Director Weeks respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Administrative Services. I appreciate the chance to respond to this. I understand the concerns that you have about how important it is for this group to be reflective of the governor's authority and so on. The reservation that we have about putting it in the governor's office is more than just institutionalization. The governor's office is not a management group. It's a policy group. And this is a team of people that are actually doing real work in the field. And the reason the governor chose to put it in the DAS, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, actually I meant to make my contribution early. I might not have enough money now, but the reason the governor...
Mr. Chair, I'd like it reflected for the record that this large wad of bills that the director is sticking into the pig would cover my laps for DAS earlier.
Your laps for DAS.
Mr. Chairman, I'm paying for Representative Johnson also in this wad.
I want it reported.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
But the governor's intent in putting it in the Department of Administrative Services is so that there is someone who's responsible for the administration, the management, the oversight of the group. That's not going to happen in the governor's office. Senate Bill 467 calls for the governor to create an Office of Community Solutions. That doesn't mean it's in the governor's office. It describes the agencies that bill describes the agencies that are going to contribute to that work and gives them certain responsibilities and so on. So it's institutionalization, but it's really recognizing that this is a function, an administrative function, and it's not unusual for part of government to be located somewhere else. The governor's ombudsman has been located in the Department of Human Services for years. Jen Dennison has a card which says she's the governor's ombudsman, but for all purposes she reported to the director of DHS and still does, and but carried the imprimatur of the governor's office. So I think you can cover that imprimatur that you're concerned about by having, you know, all the vested authority of the governor's office, but still not ask the governor to manage a group of people, which is not what the governor's office does.
Representative Petras?
Well, I guess respectfully I would disagree with the position. The whole way Community Solutions was sold was it reports directly to the governor. These are policy choices the state must make, and that it would have the full faith and credit of a director of a division rather than be buried underneath a division director. And that they would be able to come in and knock division directors' heads together to get them to cooperate with each other. I think that's the whole, I mean, since I've been here, that's the whole reason Community Solutions and the whole premise upon which Community Solutions were sold was that, you know, this group could operate to functionally cut outside the policy bounds rather than just some management function. I view these as like expediter people who are supposed to be out there wrestling the agencies to the ground. And I know that you and I have talked about the structure change and the COO of the state, some of those kinds of things. But I mean, that's specifically why I want them in the governor's office as opposed to somewhere else.
Representative Johnson?
One of the other issues that looms large for me in this discussion, and I don't expect an answer, I just want to raise it for the consideration of the committee, is whether or not we build a structure for this group that causes there to be salary adjustments that begin to approach astronomical. I think that ought to be a factor. I'm thinking about the unique blend of talents that Ms. Quigley brings to the Commission on Indian Affairs. She's an attorney with expertise in a very narrow area of the law, and I was reflecting as I looked in the book, the PICS printout, on what her remuneration is. And while I haven't worked this enough or spoken with committee staff about it, I think we need to be cautious that we don't create positions that are remunerated at such a high level that we price ourselves out of the ability to have the Community Solutions team be operational.
And perhaps what we need to do is have a portion of this conversation with Chris Warner present so that we can kind of get to the bottom of that. But that certainly, Director Weeks, doesn't supersede any of your input and discussion on it. Please proceed, Gary.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to react, to Representative Patridge's comments that the reality is that this team does not have the authority to bang heads together.
Yeah.
They don't. They haven't done it. They, unless you want to change the law and give them some authority to do that, they're not vested with that authority. I'm vested with that authority. And my job, and the reason the governor wanted this group within my office, was for someone to do exactly what Representative Patridge has suggested, to be able to bring agency heads together who had the authority to say, you will cooperate in these ways, you will provide resources, you will provide people when necessary for a conversation, and so on like that. The Community Solutions team does not have that authority at this point. I mean, they can go to the governor and ask the governor to do that, but this is what the governor is trying to get away from. He doesn't want to have to manage personally that kind of conversation. He wants somebody in the form of me to manage that kind of conversation.
Representative Johnson and then Representative Patridge.
One other thing, Mr. Weeks, that I would like a reaction to. Part of my religious conversion on the Community Solutions team was personality driven. We had people doing the work in my legislative district who, in my opinion, both out of OECDD and at the Community Solutions team, were not an optimal match with the work in my district. That's now been rectified in the folks that are doing the work, ergo my enthusiasm for the Community Solutions team. I would like your reaction to a scenario whereby a Community Solutions team person is assigned to a region, I don't care what region it is, but it is clear that it is not a good fix. talk a little bit about the pros and cons of either having the governor's office deal with having to remove one of those folks or your shop having to deal with the day-to-day management that might include having to make it clear to one of the CST members that they are not a good fit and maybe need to pursue other opportunities.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we've in fact had some of those conversations already. Chris Warner and I worked together very closely because when Chris came into the job, there were more chairs than there was resources to fill them. And we talked about, you know, how we were going to make that change, where the change ought to occur best, what the fits were on all the different districts. So we've in fact already had that kind of event occur. And I think if we found that there was a misfit somewhere, it would be a conversation between Chris and I about what he intended to do about it, what his recommendations would be, and so on. But those are conversations that the governor won't have with someone like Chris, just because he doesn't have that kind of time, and that's not the job of the governor. That's the job of someone else. So, but it's at a high enough level that we can make that kind of a change happen, and happen quickly.
One follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up.
Help me walk through the management issues relative to not only the Community Development Office, but also their partners who are the Rural Development Officers out of Oregon Economic and Community Development. Give me the pros and the cons for... again, these are highly personality-dependent people, and I happen to have had a conversation with the Rural Development Officer in my district this morning. I called him, and he called me back in about 6 seconds, Denny Houle, who I think does an extremely good job. But my question to you is, if those personalities change, give me the management structure, both the pros and the cons for DAS and the governor's office, if somehow there's a rub between the community development and the regional. How do you reconcile those in each of these management structures, either in Department of Administrative Services or in the governor's office?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think the way you'd reconcile those, if under DAS, is we would bring the parties together where the rub is occurring. Community Solutions people and the Rural Development Officers, where the rub is occurring, and we would work those out. And if it meant having to change someone, then that occurs. That's an executive branch responsibility to move people in and out and around and so on. I think those kinds of conversations are far more difficult for the governor to have, or the chief of staff to have. I mean, they're focused on policy issues. They're not focused on managing disagreements out in the field between rural development officers and community solution team members. That's not, again, to be repetitive, the work of the governor to deal with that. That's the kind of work that I'm supposed to deal with. So.
Well, last question, just to get this on the record. Assuming that the community development office stayed at DAS, what would their cards say on them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think if it were there was the belief that they have more cachet or clout to have the governor's community solutions team or governor's community solutions office, that would be what their card would say. I don't have a particular brief for how their card reads. I think it's what will get them the most access and the greatest status and level of attention and so on when they're out in the field. And if it's to have that on their card, Representative Johnson, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Let me just ask this with regard to 467 in that regard, Senate Bill 467. If something similar to what is presently proposed under that Senate bill were to become law, and then that the Community Development Office or Community Solutions Team, whatever we're going to call it, were to become answerable, probably the best place to make them answerable would be, as you're indicating, Gary, through the Department of Administrative Services. Would they then have sufficient authority to do what this particular law, as it's presently stated in this Senate bill,
would they be given that latitude through your office?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. I've read the amendments to Senate Bill 467, and I understand completely what I think the role of the Community Solutions Office would be under that bill. And if they were housed in DAS, it would be to my advantage to make sure they had the capacity to do what that bill requires them to do, and to also make sure that the seven other agencies that are named in that as key agencies
are
at the table, and not also at the table in a cooperative, participatory way.
Good. Representative Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One, Gary, you said that you have the authority. Where's that authority vested statutorily to get the bang agency heads together to get them to work policy-wise? I don't believe it's in statute.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge, it's not in statute, but the governor has been very clear, Mr. Chairman and Representative Patridge, in talking about the job that I have as the chief operating officer in state government. He's been very clear to the agencies when he's spoken directly to them that my work was to make sure that government worked effectively. In the last meeting he had with the agency heads, he said if there's an issue about the management of government, it goes through Gary Weeks.
And there's nothing preventing the governor from giving the Community Solutions Office, if it was in his office, that same authority to bang heads together as it does you?
There isn't, Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge. Okay. I'd be surprised if he would.
Okay.
Representative Patridge?
Also, I'm looking at your organizational charts on page 8 of the budget document. Well, I guess they're both on page 8, one under agency summary and one under office of the director. And I guess my concern is that this is such a high-profile issue, an important issue, why isn't it within the office of the director? I mean, we have the progress board in the office of the director on page 8 in the office of the director. Yet if you flip back to page 8 under the agency summary, this is just another division of DAS. And I guess that's my concern as we line things up and place importance on something that's critically important to communities, that this doesn't even appear in your organizational charts in the office of the director if it's such an important function. And I'm wondering how the decision was made just to put it down as a regular division as opposed to something that's supposed to be an expedited function that should get a high, in my opinion, if this is such an important thing, should get a high level of attention.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge, this organization chart was put together and supported by the governor as a part of the governor's budget. There's nothing that prohibits, if this legislature feels that it increases the profile of the Community Development Community Solutions Office, let's call it what it is in 467, to have it more directly connected as a side to the director's office. I'm fine with that. You know, if that in some way enhances the capacity for them to do the work that's either described currently or described prospectively in Senate Bill 467, you know, my job is to help them get that work done. And I understand how important the Community Solutions Office is. I mean, I want them to be successful. I want them to have access to the resources and the people that they need to do their job. And so if it makes it clearer that that's a priority, I'm happy to change the org chart. We developed this, though, without knowing the kind of conversation we would be in today, Representative. And I mean, I feel similarly about things that you and I have talked about in terms of the CIO. Chief Information Officer is going to report to the director of this department. Now it shows the Information Resource Management as a division here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's continue on with the Office of the Director then.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, going on with my recommendations then. Pretty much, you'll see throughout, and this will be the start of what you'll expect to see, is a reduction of, in this case, the Office of the Director general fund appropriation and other funds limitation by $20,159 and $22,220 respectively for effect of the salary freezes and the inflation adjustment. Again, the inflation adjustment is to bring the agencies to those controllable inflation. There were certain areas where if it's non-controllable, like if outside rent or something, we didn't back it out, but bring it down to zero. And the salary freezes are very fairly nominal in the director's office because everyone's at the top step. Also, our recommendation, in discussion, there's a policy option package included in here to reduce their expenditure limitation by some, well, a little over $250,000 to move the highway cost allocation study to the Department of Transportation. You had testimony supporting leaving it in this office to be conducted by the Office of Economic Analysis under the Director's Office. Our recommendation, and there seemed to be there was support from the Department of Administrative Services to fund that. So our recommendation is to restore that and to bring it up to the balance, be about $460,000 for the biennium. My recommendation for increasing the other funds limitation by $690,533 really restores the negative and then brings it up to the appropriate balance, and this has been agreed upon by the Department of Transportation. And we will work with make sure that the Department of Transportation budget would reflect this transfer or a limitation to ensure that the proper amount of funds come to the department to achieve this. The policy option package did have a reduction of 0.50 FTE, which they asked not to be restored. So we're not restoring the position, but just the funding for the conduct of the highway cost allocation study. That's the staff's recommendation for the Office of the Director. Would you like me to continue off of the memorandum?
Yeah, any questions regarding the Office of the Director relative to the salary freezes, inflation adjustment, or the cost allocation study? No further salary or no additional steps from being.
That's correct.
Okay, Representative Patridge?
I think pursuant to Director Week's comments on the CIO, if we're going to move, I mean, my recommendation is to do something different, but if we are going to move the CIO to the Office of the Director, we need to reflect that instead of down on IRMD as we prep the budget filing.
Okay. Let's come back to that when we go into the information portion of it here in just a moment. Thank you.
Dallas?
Okay. The next division is the Budget and Management Division. Staff's recommendation is to reduce other funds expenditure limitation by $216,636, again, for salary freezes and the inflation adjustment. This division is all other funded through assessments, and this will be one of those adjustments that will reduce agency assessments. Other than that, there were no policy option packages or anything. This is our recommendation for Budget and Management Division. The State Controllers Division, our recommendation is to reduce other funds expenditure limitation by $209,208 for the salary freeze and inflation adjustment. In addition, a reduction of other funds expenditure limitation by $368,727 and the elimination of three vacant positions, which are 3.0 FTE. We will be recommending some elimination of vacant positions throughout. This is the first division in the sequence. I'd like to point out that the original list that we received of vacant positions from the department was really long. It had a lot of duplication in it. It double counted things. It actually had positions that were unfunded and not paid for. Merely, we think they were commissioned positions that were put in the system probably to allow for payment of per diem and the like. We have taken the liberty, if you will, of working with the department to eliminate all that, those excess positions in the system that really, for all intents and purposes, didn't exist. These are real positions that for which there is funding authority, and we've reviewed this with the department. So this will be the first of the vacant positions that we would be recommending.
So these are real positions that are being eliminated.
Yeah, they are vacant positions, and funding authority carried forward. And we are recommending elimination of the funding and the positions.
Okay.
I should like to point out that in addition to these reductions, agencies will save another $651,451 from reductions in agency assessments that were included in the price list originally, but no longer needed because the salary, because of the policy option packages for which the price list was developed, weren't brought forward in the governor's recommended budget. So in effect, what we have is billings to agencies for which there's no concurrent expenditure required. So we will be, that's part of the reduction that you saw in that one sheet following where we kind of enumerated the reductions in agency assessments. So the impact of the reduction in the controller's division on assessments reductions will be increased because of the reduction for those policy option packages that were originally included in the price list.
Okay, on to information resource management, if there's no questions there.
The first recommendation is to reduce the other funds expenditure limitation by $1,481,211 for salary freezes and inflation adjustment. In addition, if you remember, there was a placeholder policy option package. It was number 450 in the department's budget for this, and this was the one that was generally defined as technology infrastructure support or development. Mr. Weeks and his staff had testified during the public hearings about the governor's intention to provide additional infrastructure support. They hadn't fleshed out the idea or what was it going to be in this package, but there was a placeholder package. In the interim, or in the intervening time, they have acknowledged that they expect it to cost less than was in the package, and that's reflected in staff's recommendation. It's with the department's concurrence. In fact, it was their number to reduce that package by $1,224,834, actually to reflect the refined strategy for this technology infrastructure investment that they want to make. The department has prepared, and I'm somewhat supportive, I am supportive of it, of adding 16 positions that weren't in the package. They hadn't been identified yet because the strategy hadn't been defined for purposes of these investments. Again, the package, this is a reduction in funding but an increase in FTE because the original package hadn't been, the funding, they just wanted it set aside. And they have provided, they have something. Did you bring it with you, Jim?
That refined strategy, is that what you're looking
yes,
for?
Yes, the refined strategy. We have something from the department.
Perhaps we can have it.
There are about three different initiatives. And what I would... what I would propose, Mr. Chair, is that we review this and go through the details, because this is something significant. Excuse me.
Thank you.
This is the refined the refined strategy for the technology infrastructure
right.
investments to add the 16 positions for the purposes of technology infrastructure investment.
Yes, what we handed out is a revised policy option package 450, and the first page is a general, it's a summary of the areas that they want to place emphasis on: enterprise network services, enterprise planning and policy, and general government data center. The details then on the position are on the third page of that handout. And most of the positions are really in the enterprise network services, about nine positions, eight or nine. And they are IS people, fund manager and all IS folks. What they intend to achieve with this is laid out in here, but we have, I think I would defer to them to present this, Mr. Chair, if with your permission. There's also in policy and planning area six permanent positions, and additional support is needed in the general government data center. Right now, they're working overtime and comp time, increasing demands on the data center, and it has suffered from insufficient staffing in the past. Again, we have been supportive of use of the General Government Data Center for various agencies. PERS comes to mind immediately with housing their data warehouse. Other agencies are also taking advantage of the General Government Data Center.
Has any of this been reviewed with either Representative Gallegos or Representative Patridge? Do we know at this point? Representative Patridge?
We haven't looked at this updated policy pack, Mr. Chair, and I'm also concerned.
Who's the third member on that committee? I'm sorry.
Representative Hunt.
Okay. I beg your pardon.
No, there's just issues with the General Government Data Center and even its ability to continue on. And while we may be able to throw more people at the planning pieces, they've had people look at this. And so I guess I just am concerned that we don't have any money to upgrade the infrastructure. It doesn't do us a lot of good to try and move people over to the General Government Data Center if the thing's not even up to standard, I guess. Dallas.
What you're saying, Representative Patridge, if I could, by asking her, are you saying that coming up with an implementation plan but recognizing we won't have the money to implement?
Something like that.
Okay, all right. Okay, let me ask this, and this is a question relative to that information technology group. You're not formally meeting yet at this particular point?
We've been informally meeting. DAS has provided us some information. Cindy's worked with us to provide some information. We're trying to get our arms around basically where we're looking at statewide.
And Representatives Hunt and Gallego are
getting the information, okay, too. So, but we're waiting to get some information back from the governor, frankly.
Okay. And so policy option package 450 is, you know, if it's the speaker's intention to go ahead and ask, I recognize
the speaker and the co-chair have asked us to move ahead on what we want to do with IT stuff.
So will that be a joint, so we get Senate representation in that process?
I think at this point in time we're gathering the data and asking the governor. And really, it's the governor's question as to what we want.
Okay.
I mean, he has to either take leadership in this area or not take leadership.
I just wondered
but we disagree on how the leadership should be taken. So.
Yeah, I just wondered from a procedural standpoint how that recommendation would be coming down. I had a little bit of housekeeping here, but
we'll get the Senate involved as soon as we get our arms around some basics.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Winters.
Kind of sooner than later.
Well, we've talked to several of the Senate people who've been involved in IT before. So.
Okay. Anything further? You were on page 3, Dallas.
Yes. If I may, we'll finish with the information resource management. We are also recommending there's a reduction of the other fund expenditure limitation, $164,485, and elimination of 7 vacant positions, 6.38 FTE. Some of the expenditure limitations for positions have been used in other permanent funding actions for existing staff, either reclasses up and down or reorgs, but there would be a reduction in limitation as well as the elimination of 7 vacant positions. Also, the department has proposed, and we agree with it, reduce other funds expenditure limitation by $184,638. And there are no positions, but there are some FTE associated with this, so 2.25, to phase out the statewide directory assistance program. And this is with an idea of transferring the work to the probably corrections, not to get rid of directory assistance, but have it housed over their Department of Corrections with their answering services. So the Department of Administrative Services will be working with corrections with respect to that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Pat Johnson.
A question for the LFO staff. Expand a little bit on what that directory assistance does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, basically if someone calls into the state, there's one number you can call the state government, and you can get a directory assistance to say, well, how do I legislate fiscal or Department of Administrative Services or Revenue Department? There's, it's kind of a one number like 411 information. Most state governments will have it, and it'll be in the white pages usually, and correct me if I'm mistaken, you know, for state government information, call this number, and it's usually one number. And from there, they're expected to direct the calls to the appropriate, and even be able to transfer it if they have the capability to those various agencies.
Can they transfer now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, can they transfer a call now?
I apologize. I've never called the number.
And it's a 1-800 master number. I think. What we've proposed is the LFO is that corrections can manage this, we believe, just like they're doing a number of other contract kinds of jobs, like with the Florida Health Fund.
Here, did you come to the mic?
I apologize.
Shouldn't have been doing that. Representative Johnson, the corrections department now does a lot of work under the Oregon Health Plan, enrollments and so on like that. We are just proposing that we don't need to do this directory assistance work. We think it could be done by corrections under an agreement with corrections, and that you'd use inmate labor to perform that. And we save 2.25 FTE, and we'd have the same service and same capacity to transfer calls and so on like that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. In addition, there's the department is proposing, and we concur because it gets rid of duplication of activities, I think, is this would be to reduce the other fund's limitation and non-limited authority by $889,795 and $637,087, respectively, and reduce the number of positions by four and four FTE. And this is to transfer that training program that has resided in Information Resource Management Division to the Department of Administrative Services Human Resource Services Division, which has personnel training program. So this would, within the department, consolidate training for state agency folks and various personnel, just the training of state employees that the department has responsibility for. Instead of having it in two divisions, it would place it in one. You'll see when we get to the Human Resource Services Division, the funding and the authority, positions to come back there.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, a question for Mr. Weeks, if you wouldn't mind asking him to come back. This training program had been somewhat of a problem for me. I lived through the days at ODOT when there was a training section. I think you were out of state during that time. But a training section that superseded the budget of the division that I was managing on behalf of ODOT. And as the chief operating officer for the state, I'm looking for some reassurance from you that this breathtaking proliferation of agency training programs is being gathered in, and somebody's got their arms around it and is watching what the individual agencies are doing. And I want to make it absolutely clear for the record, I think when Bruce Warner came to ODOT, he got his arms around the training that was going on there. And I brook no criticism with Bruce Warner at all, but in the bad old days at ODOT, the training there was just unbelievably expensive and of marginal value. So I'm really looking for your assurance that agency training is something under your very watchful, careful eye.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, it is under my watchful, careful eye. And you addressed two problems. You know, one whether the level of training actually provides any real support for staff, and two, you know, what we're paying for it. And we're moving this from IR, Information Resource Management Division, to our training group in Human Resources, so that we've got a consolidated training program. Our training group offers training all across the state and to other agencies, many other agencies. We're also trying to get agencies who are providing training now to open that training to other agencies, so we don't have, you know, the same kind of training going on umpteen million different times, you know. But instead, if ODOT's going to provide some training that benefits, let's say, a diversity program or something, we open that up and we let other agencies come in and we pay for it one time, and that's our initiative. We just hired a new training manager a woman who has worked with, we hired her from IBM. She's done a lot of training work across the country in different jobs, and we're very optimistic that she's going to be able to give us a good hard look at all the training that goes on, not only through DAS, but through other parts of state government.
Well, and follow up, Mr. Chair. And I hope that that training passed the laugh test on the outside. I mean, I remember the good old days at ODOT where for $5,000 a guy brought an inflatable Godzilla dressed up in a suit and taught us all to be samurai managers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was outrageous. And I'd like summary assurance that the training programs are relevant, past the front page of the Oregonian laugh test, and that we're not as duplicative. And again, this was in a time long before Bruce Warner, so I want to make that absolutely clear.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we will do our best to make sure we don't have any plastic Godzillas out there. I too, do not want to read about this in the Oregonian, and there were examples at the lottery, I think, in its audit of costly training of with questionable value, and we don't want to be in that place. So we're going to be working with the training managers at all the agencies to, you know, to try to get people to think carefully about what is it that we're going to deliver in training. Is it what's required to get the job done, and how do we do it in the most cost-effective way? That's the questions for the training manager.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The last item we have for just an informational, the division, Information Resource Management Division, has a reduction of 3 cents per minute for, it's actually toll-free, the toll-free rate, and it expects to save about $1.5 million from all state agencies' budgets. I confirmed this. That's a lot of minutes that's on the toll-free number, but the reduction should save state agencies about $1.5 million. And then we'll also have a reduction in assessments of $711,575 from assessments that were included in the price list. But again, the policy option package didn't move forward, so we will be reducing state agency assessments for that.
And specifically, what are those, what kinds of policy option packages for the savings of the 711?
I'd have to go back.
And is the cost per minute, is that on the basis of a bid?
Yes.
Cora Parker.
Mr. Chair, Cora Parker from the Department of Administrative Services. That was package 341, and actually the package is still included in the governor's balanced budget, but we revised it. We changed some of what was in it, how it was presented from the agency in the original request, and so that 711 was the savings that we eliminated in the governor's budget. Just for the record, to make clear, this package and the other packages that Mr. Wayne has spoke about this morning, typically, if the budget process worked out in the timeline that we all would have liked it to have worked out, you would have seen these dollars actually taken during the governor's budget process. And we simply did not have the opportunity to do that. So that's why he's cleaning that up and doing that for us this morning.
Okay. Any questions relative to that as we wrap up the information management division?
And, Mr. Chair, you were aware that the 3% of the savings was from the bid process.
Okay. That savings is $1.5 million.
Across state agencies, yes, Mr. Chair.
And that 3 cents a minute, is that coming up with 5 million minutes, or is that five?
It's a lot of minutes, Mr. Chair. I checked it myself.
It sounds like my daughter's phone.
4.7 million minutes. We have I confirmed this with the interim CIO this morning. Is that for real? And the answer was yes. But their usage is that high.
I can say I haven't seen that kind of a savings on, you know, since my teenage daughter was at home. So. Okay.
Having a stepdaughter, I'm aware.
Yes.
The next one is the Public Employees Benefit Board. Here the reduction, the proposed reduction, is simply a reduction of $56,465 for salary freezes and inflation adjustment. This one also had I should point out that we are very supportive of the policy option package that would increase this agencies, staffing by three. They desperately need the staff. The issues surrounding health care insurance and dealing with providers and vendors and all sorts of things has just, it's been an exponential effect on their workload. They've been managing to manage it very well, and they're automating, remember, if you will, from the public testimony to help them do that, but they will be increasing staff slightly. The next division is the
Chairman. Representative Pappage?
So you are recommending $350, their policy office?
Yes, I am.
So unless there's something that's different here, you're recommending their policy office?
Right. Unless I'm starting from the governor's recommended budget. Which
okay. And we've also tagged this particular budget in relationship to what we're doing with the bill that Representative Williams sponsored, and I know that there's
yes, we have been
surrounding that issue.
I have been working on our staff are involved along with the governor's staff in and other the bills that would, I guess, the proposal is to bring K-12 under this or allow them to access health care insurance, and we have been working with representatives. The Human Resource Services Division, again, there is a reduction of other funds expenditure limitation by $395,067 for salary freezes and inflation adjustment. Here we are recommending the elimination of two vacant positions, which is 1.92 FTE. The limitation for these positions is being used now to fund other personal services for permanent financing, either through reorganizations or reclassifications. But we are getting rid of them. These are two more vacant positions that are being eliminated. The next one is an increase of the other funds expenditure limitation and non-limited authority, and the increase in position authority to reflect the transfer of the training from Human Resource Services Division to this division. And lastly, in addition to the reductions above that,
let me just ask a question there. That matches then the RMD information resources.
If it doesn't, it's because of a typo. It matches.
So in the one it is reduced, and then we replace it back in the human resources.
Overall, it has no effect
for the training program.
Right.
My concern is that there were other training programs in other places. Are we capturing all of those, Dallas?
Within the Department of Administrative Services, there were two training offices, if you will, and they are in Human Resource Services Division and in Information Resource Management
okay.
Division. We are consolidating those.
All going back to Human Resources. Or Human Resource Services, yes. Okay. Thank you.
Then, also, state agencies will save $809,458 from reduction in agency assessments, again, that were included in the price list, but because of the timing of the preparation of the governor's budget, couldn't be taken out of the price list when the governor's balanced budget was prepared.
Any questions relative to the recommendations on the Human Resource Services Division? Representative Patrick?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I still don't have a good handle on human resources and how much of it is to support DASA's internal structure versus how much of this is outsourced, Dallas.
Mr. Chair,
other agencies.
This one, this is all of the outside, if you will, for reviewing of all classification changes, ensuring state policies on personnel are being followed, so that this. The Department of Administrative Services internally, if it wants to seek a reclass, has to flow it through this division. So this is kind of the one that is the central core support to all state agencies. One of those is the Department of Administrative Services. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters?
On the reclass, and we we haven't done anything about it, but it was an issue that we raised during e-board of the fact that this body no longer has any oversight on reclassing.
If I may address that.
Yes, please,
Mr. Chairman, last session we provided additional audit resources, and they have been out there reviewing agencies' actions now a lot more aggressively because they have the resources. And if you'll remember, you may have missed it during the testimony provided, they have actually saved some money this time. They have they're finding that upon reviewing the reclasses and position actions that have been taken, agencies have erred more on upward reclassifications than downward reclassifications, and they're actually causing agencies to rescind those adjustments. So we are starting to see benefits from the resources we provided there before. One of their first assignments, if you will, was from a budget note in the Public Employees Retirement System, where we asked them to go and do a wall-to-wall review of all position classifications, and they found out of 200-some-odd positions, there were 35 that had been improperly classified. So they are now being far more proactive because of the resources we provided last time, and we are achieving some of the desired results.
Mr. Chair, my point was, historically in the past, before this was turned over and the legislative body turned this activity over to the agencies, that the legislature did do an oversight, and that was to control this whole issue of agencies just automatically reclassifying, and it does have a tremendous budgetary implications. It's my understanding that this body back did that because they didn't have no longer wanted to be involved in the minutia. However, it's sometimes that the minutia keeps us from where we're not spending dollars unwisely. And unless there is some kind of process to where you are getting into those audits, it does create, I think, some future problems. Right now we're in a tight budget climate, so we're looking with very critical eyes. But when we're not in tight budget climate, sometimes there is the pattern for agencies and individuals to reclassify, and this body has no control over that.
And what are the controls now? With this implementation, will there be any additional?
We may let the department address this, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, for the record, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department. The controls really are that in order to reclass a position, you have to develop permanent financing for them. But that's not that hard to do if you change another position to half-time or abolish a position. And so there are ways to manage this. And I think when the legislature made the decision to give this back to the executive branch, it was in part a workload issue, too, because your LFO office was doing a review of all these at the time. And it was backed by this pledge that, when it goes to the executive branch, we're going to have a real strong audit of all these reclasses. Well, in fact, there never were positions provided to do that, and I was running agencies during this time. I knew really well there was never going to be any audit because there was no one to do an audit, and so the agencies, were able to I think take advantage in many ways to be candid, and now we have more capacity to do the audits. We're going to be much more serious about it, but the control has always been sort of you rely on what's budgeted, and they have to stay within what's budgeted. But within what's budgeted gives you a lot of capacity to move around and adjust. And I think agencies may historically have taken a position, reduced it halftime, took the savings, used it to reclass a position, and then come back to you in the next biennium and said, we need this halftime back to full-time. And they sort of restored their loss.
So, Gary, will we be able to get a better handle on it? Through these modifications and improvements?
Mr. Chairman, I believe with a real serious audit program, we are going to get a better handle on it. And, you have
capable
to...
Capable of doing that.
Right. You have to start with getting the sense among the agencies that somebody's going to come in and look at what you're doing. Look at your reclasses. And, I mean, even now, agency heads come to me at this point before they start any kind of major reclass package to say, is this going to fly? And
is there any report required in this process, Gary? That's strictly internal.
Well, we used to I don't know if it's changed since I left, but we used to provide you with a report on abolishments, reclasses, and so on like that. I don't know if we
that's still throughout that state government we're talking about.
That's
isn't
true
it?
through the emergency board process, through the compensation report that comes to you.
Okay.
But also internally, just to add to what Gary has said, and I think we talked about this some during public hearing, process now is, I think, a lot stricter than it was in the past, in that pretty much every position that comes to a permanent financing request, there are probably a few exceptions, but they are definitely the exception and not the rule, that come through the Budget and Management Division, get looked at there from a fiscal standpoint, but also go to the HRSD unit for a review to make sure that it makes sense as far as where they're moving the position. So regardless of whether they've got the dollars or not, which the director has talked about, you can have the dollars. There could be reasons that you've got the flexibility, but regardless of whether you do or not, if HRSD says, no, this position doesn't need to be where you're trying to reclass it, they will say no. And we have, in the last year or so, we've denied several packages through that process.
Let's see. Senator Winters, follow up.
I want to follow up because I'm very concerned about this issue. Because during the last year, and it was with the Department of Human Services, and I know that the entity went to DAS to ask for permission, who then came to me, and they had the dollars, and I said politically, you better not. And we were talking about reclassification of some 40 positions. I'm very concerned that there's either the audits in place, but something that's in place that really triggers, it says that when you say no, that it is no.
I think what we're talking about here, though, is that basically by putting the best game warden is a former poacher. Excuse me. I can say it. I shouldn't say it like that. Senator Devlin and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to go back a long ways to some of our prior discussion and hearing. If my memory is correct on reclassifications, there was testimony that while DAS had purview over some reclassifications, that several major state agencies, reclassifications are totally under their purview in the sense that it's been delegated to them to do reclassifications. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, yeah, that is correct. They have delegated authority, but that does not... It does not mean they don't go through the audit process like every other agency does. So DAS or DHS had delegated authority, but they're still subject to the audit of all reclasses, abolishments, and creation of new positions.
Follow up, Senator.
I have some of the same concerns as Senator Winters, and I understand that there may be justifications for any changes that take effect in an agency. But in terms of, have we ever done any studies to see if there is any sort of reclassification creep within an agency, in the sense of you would think that you'd be able to look at all the positions within an agency, and we have a range system, although we have different classifications, but we have salary ranges, and you'd see some sort of a pattern over time. If that pattern stays the same, you probably wouldn't look for too much of a difference. But if this pattern starts to shift towards higher classifications, there may be a justification for that. But if you saw that shift happening over time, I think it would be worthy of exploration. I remember on a very small scale an agency that I once dealt with that had about only just a subcomponent of the agency that had about only 12 or 13 positions in a particular division. But it was interesting that over about a 10-year time, those went from about four different levels of classifications to practically everybody being in the maximum classification for the type of work they were doing.
Mr. Chairman, we haven't done that kind of sort of longitudinal research that Senator Devlin has asked about. We probably, I'm just thinking about this, we'd probably do it the most effectively by salary range, not classification, because the problem is the classifications change. You know, jobs are rewritten and so on like that. But you could determine creep if you looked at what, you know, what's happened with the salary ranges in an agency 10 years ago to where are they now, you know. And you probably get some information from that sort of look.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Becker, Assistant Director of Department of Administrative Services. One of the continuing challenges is separating out classification from compensation. And what you'll see is some agencies are looking to compensate people by reclassifying them. And what DAS is doing, one of the things that they're doing when they're looking at doing the audits is looking at that issue. If it's a compensation issue, we need to deal with it in another way besides a classification issue, which really is the work different?
I think that's what the expression of concern is here, Cindy, is that that's what, it's the bracket creep that's a concern to us. Representative Johnson?
Go
right ahead, Cindy.
Well, and we have a team of people that, those are the positions that you authorized last session that are going out and doing these studies. We have that information. We'd be happy to share that with you. You can see where they're doing random samples from various agencies and looking at various issues.
Does LFO have that information?
I don't know if we can give you the reports that we've done.
Please. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I know that this is a very serious subject. I'm going to interrupt just briefly with your permission introduce second through seventh graders from the Black Butte School and their teacher, Tony Foster. These folks are all from Camp Sherman, and even though I represent a different district, being a Central Oregon girl, my heart still resides over there. So they came to observe the Capitol today and sit in on a committee. They've been to the Gold Man, and they're going to watch the session.
Well, great.
Mr. Chair, I want to know how many were fly fisher persons.
Well, it's good to have you here today. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other comment to Director Weeks. When I came as a new manager to state government, I don't recall any kind of uniform training for new managers with respect to the issue raised by my colleague, Senator Devlin, and that is scope creep on reclassifications. Mm-hmm. I bet I hadn't been in my job 20 minutes when the pressure to look at reclasses began. And I shamefully admit in this public setting that I wrote some rather masterful pieces of fiction in order to justify reclasses inside the shop. It is of concern to me that if you have good creative writers in managerial positions, the scope creep occurs unabated. And I just commend that piece of intelligence to you for your review as you deal with the problem of scope creep.
Representative Johnson, Mr. Chairman, I think that is true. We can be victims of very creative writing, but part of the whole audit process is to, you know, desk audit people and say, is what you're doing every day the same thing as this wonderfully written position description? And if not, then you're in the wrong classification. But it's, as Cindy pointed out to you, managers want to use the classification system as a way to reward employees, and they particularly are trying to do it right now because the governor has said we're freezing all salaries, all benefits, no special merits, the only way to get around that is to have a reclass package, and so we're being very careful on every reclass package that comes in at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Senator. Representative.
You may have answered this while I was outside the door. How many reclass packages are on your desk right now, or on who's ever responsible for oversight?
Boy, I don't know. Cora, would you have any idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can say very few compared to the history over the last few years. Basically, the message out to agencies was we're looking at these and we're looking at them carefully. And unless the request passes the conditions that were laid out in both the governor's direction and then supported by the legislative body, the answer is going to be no, so basically don't waste your time going through the process. So we have very few. I have seen a significant decrease in what's coming through.
Well, in the main, I'm satisfied with that answer. Given the volatility of this issue, I would like to know the number. And I am very pleased that it is less than it used to be, because I think that Senator Devlin has hit on something by pointing out that scope creep in reclasses, I think, is pandemic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there are other kinds of ways to move around our system that we also have to pay attention to. Work out a class. You know, if somebody's working out a class for a long time, you should be asking the question about why don't we revise the class then, you know, or how long the duty's going to last and so on like that. Special merit increases, which we basically shut down at this point. There aren't any special merit increases, but that's another way historically that you could get around the progress of the regular systems.
Thank you. Further, Senator?
Mr. Chair, I raise that because there are a number of ways that you can get around the system, and with little oversight by this body. And I just wanted to flag it because it was a concern that we raised at E-Board, and it was enough of a concern that we pushed for the audit. And I wanted on the record so that next time that we will address some of these issues we'll get to talk about, so that we as a body are paying attention to it as well as the agency.
Representative Patridge.
Chair, I would just like to see the PICS report for this particular division. I'd be interested to know how HR is set up on its, because we don't have any of the PICS reports for any of the division, unless they're back here.
We can get them there. Okay. The back line.
Okay. Yeah. I'd like to see some of the PICS reports for the various divisions.
Okay. We're completing then the fifth of the nine divisions within the Department of Administrative Services. I believe that the Senate meets at 10:30, and in deference to our members from the Senate, as we come out of work sessions, we'll go ahead and pick this back up tomorrow. We'll have a satisfaction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, we will go ahead and stand at recess until tomorrow at even time when we will pick back up House Bill 5002, Department of Administrative Services. Stand at recess.
It says binders on the panel.